Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. My next guest is the moral philosopher, Susan, and forgive me, I didn't check the pronunciation of your name. Is it Neiman or Nyman?
It's Neiman in English.
Okay, Susan Neiman, N-E-I-M-A-N. She grew up as a white child in the South. She lives as a Jewish adult in Germany, the way she puts it. For a new book, she moved back to the South, to Mississippi, to be exact, for about 6 months to compare through grown-up eyes how Germany has dealt with its legacy of Nazism to how the U.S. deals with its legacy of slavery and centuries of anti-black discrimination. The book is out now, called Learning from the Germans, Race and the Memory of Evil. Thank you so much for joining us. Welcome to WNYC.
Pleasure to be here.
I see that your book was inspired by the aftermath of the Charleston, South Carolina church massacre in 2015. Of course, the calculated white supremacist point-blank shootings by Dylann Roof, who murdered 9 African-American churchgoers and wounded 3 others. Why this book from that horror?
So this book has 2 beginnings. The first one was really as I was standing in my apartment in Berlin in June 2015, watching President Obama give the eulogy for the 9 murdered Charlestonians. And
that famous moment where he broke out into
sang
song.
Sang Amazing Grace. Yes, my president sang Amazing Grace. And I was in tears, but I was also, as the next day and the day after wore on, I also felt rather hopeful because it seemed to me that President Obama was carrying the country along with him. Nikki Haley, of all people, was taking down the Confederate flag. Walmart said...
Governor of South Carolina at that time, Nikki Haley.
Right.
Republican.
Walmart, not exactly a progressive company, was announcing it was no longer going to sell Confederate memorabilia. And it seemed to me that America was in the process of doing something that the Germans have a long compound word for, as they have for many things, Vergangenheitsaufarbeitung. Don't worry about pronouncing it. I translate that as working off the past. And at just about the same time, Germany welcomed 1 million refugees. And when I say welcome, it meant not just standing on train platforms with signs saying welcome, taking people into their homes, donating huge amounts of food and clothing, spending their time teaching people German, helping them through the bureaucracy, playing music or soccer with the children.
These are Syrian refugees mostly.
Exactly. None of whom probably would have been refugees had it not been for the war our country started in Iraq, but that's too long ago for anybody to remember. And you will probably have heard that there's been a backlash in Germany towards the refugees. There are always backlashes, but it is still the case that there are more people, almost twice as many people, actively engaged in refugee integration than voted for our right-wing anti-immigrant party. And it's important to remember that if America did something similar, it would have welcomed 5 million refugees.
So has Germany been maybe the most welcoming Western country to the Syrian refugees, in your opinion, because of its reckoning with the Holocaust?
Absolutely.
That's not a stretch.
No, it's not a stretch at all. That's what people say. I mean, not just the Holocaust. It's important to understand that the Nazis committed a lot of crimes, but it is definitely part of making up for, atoning for the crimes that the Nazis committed.
We'll get to the better parts of how the country of Germany, the people of Germany atoned after that. But you do write about Germany getting off to a shaky start after the Holocaust in coming to grips with it. For example, East Germany and West Germany in post-war divided Germany had different versions of denial, you wrote. Could you describe those two types of denial briefly?
Sure. Actually, East Germany did a much better job than West Germany for the first 40 years of their existence because...
40 years, that's the entire time they were under communism.
Almost, yeah. Because the people who were leaders of East Germany had been genuine anti-fascists. Remember that the Nazis went after communists and social democrats before they went after Jews. So there was a genuine opposition to the Nazis and to fascism. It was sometimes instrumentalized, but from the leadership.
What does instrumentalized mean?
So the worst example of that is calling the wall the anti-fascist protection wall. Okay, so because anti-fascism was a state ideology, it could get abused. However, I would rather have it be the state ideology than what happened in the other half of Germany for a very long time, which was the belief that the Germans were the war's worst victims. 7 million of their people were killed, their cities were destroyed, they lost about a third of their territory, they were hungry, just barely alive. I hope you get the reference. Mm-hmm. On top of that, those ignorant Yankees were trying to say that it was all their fault. Now, one epiphany that I had in writing this book.
What do you mean by get the reference, by the way? Do you need to make something a little more explicit?
Sorry, the night they drove old Dixie down, because one of the epiphanies I had while writing this book is that the Germans in the first 20, 25 years after the war sounded like nothing so much as the defenders of the lost cause. We were the worst victims. And it's interesting.
The lost cause, a phrase sometimes used for the Confederacy.
Thank you. People mourning the Confederacy and blaming the Yankees and so on. And it's interesting because when I first came to Berlin in 1982, many people would tell me with a lot of shame and pain that their parents had been Nazis, but they were too ashamed to actually say they were Nazis and they thought they were the war's worst victims. That was the view. Hmm. Now, why is this good news?
You got me.
Yeah. Americans tend to use. First of all, they don't think about the whole scope of Nazi crimes. They focus on the Holocaust, and they focus on the last piece of the Holocaust, which was rounding up civilians, putting them in cattle cars, and gassing them at the end of their journeys. And rather than looking at how that began or what happened after it was over, the Holocaust has come to serve as a symbol of absolute evil. It's a way of outsourcing evil. So the assumption is it must have been the case that the Germans at the end of the war fell down on their knees and begged pardon from the world, having seen that they had committed the clearest form of evil. That's
no.
Not how they saw it. The reason I think this is good news is the first thing we can learn from the Germans is it's really hard to face up to your shameful past, even if you're a Nazi.
Now, you trace the beginning of the real reckoning to the late 1960s. The 60s protest movements were in full swing all over the Western world against Vietnam and the war there, against racism and colonialism and more. How did that change post-Holocaust Germany?
Well, young people whose parents and teachers had been Nazis, or in the best cases, not done anything against them, were outraged. And they began to look at their histories, insist that their parents and teachers look at their histories, and they were not thanked for it, with the very, very brief exception of Willy Brandt, who was a social democrat and only served as chancellor for a couple of years. People will know the famous picture of him kneeling in front of the Warsaw Ghetto Memorial. What they won't know is that the majority of Germans didn't think that was a good idea. The rest of us thought it was. We didn't. And, they were the people who were involved in the civil engagement of insisting that the country look at its history were called nest fowlers. They were not thanked. The reason I think this is good news is it means that Americans shouldn't be surprised that when the New York Times, for example, publishes the 1619 Project, Newt Gingrich is going to go ballistic and talk about, this is tearing apart the nation's fabric and we need to have a strong national identity and pride in our country. Mm-hmm. That happened in Germany, too.
Mm-hmm.
But the good news is that the German people persisted And it did not tear up the national identity. It was something that had to be worked through. But they have come out much better on the other side.
So we've been talking mostly about Germany so far. And if you're just joining us, my guest is moral philosopher Susan Neiman, whose new book is called Learning from the Germans, Race and the Memory of Evil. And it's about what we can learn from Germans post-Holocaust with respect to how the U.S. might deal with its legacy of slavery and centuries of other anti-black discrimination. We can take phone calls for her with questions or thoughts at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And we'll shift the scene from Germany to the U.S. with Susan Neiman right after this.
Next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour, Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi on the prospect of impeachment.
If the Senate decides that they have better things to do that day, so they acquit. He's impeached forever if we go down that path. You are impeached forever should we go down that path.
Nancy Pelosi, next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour. Tomorrow morning at 10 on 93.9 FM, WNYC.
WNYC is supported by the New Jersey Performing Arts Center, presenting blues guitarist Buddy Guy with R&B and gospel singer Mavis Staples, Sunday, November 10th at 7 p.m., part of the T.D. James Moody Jazz Festival. Tickets at njpac.org. New York Presbyterian, New York's top-ranked hospital for 18 years in a row, according to the 2018-19 rankings by U.S. News & World Report. Amazing things are happening here. Learn more at nyp.org/amazingfacts.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and again with moral philosopher Susan Neiman, author of Learning from the Germans, Race and the Memory of Evil. She grew up in the South. She's living as an adult in Germany, white and Jewish for that context. Your section on the South begins with a bold assertion that Mississippi today ranks near the bottom of the 50 states, as many people know it does, in things like health, quality of schools, per capita income, and you say largely because of a white backlash against Reconstruction ongoing in some way to this day. That's strong stuff.
It is strong stuff. Let me preface my remarks, though, by I don't want to be in New York City, let's say, supporting Northern prejudices against the South. First of all, by focusing on Mississippi, I didn't mean to say that racism isn't a problem elsewhere. As I'm sure mm-hmm. most of the listeners know, mm-hmm. New York has the most segregated school system in the country.
We talk about it a lot.
But Mississippi in particular is like a magnifying glass for looking at the rest of the country, and that's why I focused on it. I also met some of the best social activists there, black and white, that I've ever met anywhere. So it's an interesting place to look at both good and evil. So Reconstruction was not only a matter of ensuring that freed African Americans get the civil rights that they had been promised in the 13th Amendment. It was also the beginning of the whole idea that the state is responsible for the well-being of its citizens with things like public orphanages, taking care of widows, instituting the beginning of a public school system. And the fact that that came from the North, guarded by federal troops, one must say, and there was also the beginning of reparations, by the way. The 40 acres and a mule were in fact given to thousands of African Americans at the time, again, imposed by federal troops until 1877, has created a resentment among white Southerners against any program coming from the federal government The great Southern historian Charles Regan Wilson told me that in the 50s, people like Strom Thurmond regularly were very vocal about Reconstruction and making the connection between federal programs and Reconstruction. Now it's more subterranean, but it's a very deep unconscious resistance. And of course, even for people who would benefit tremendously from Obamacare and all kinds of other things, still have this, shall we say, underground memory of those damn Yankees pushing things. But of course, once again, I don't want to just blame the South. Mm-hmm. The really striking thing when you begin to study the South is the way in which it managed to control the narrative for the entire country, or at least for a great deal of the country. And it did that through Hollywood. Let's not remember the first blockbusters in film were pro-Confederate, even pro-Klan movies, Birth of a Nation and Gone with the Wind. But when you start looking at it, it turns out that Hollywood was turning out hundreds of pro-Confederate narratives. And I think it's important to remember, as I did in the reference to The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down, which occurred to me driving on the New Jersey Turnpike about a year ago. This is Bob Dylan's band. Dylan went to Mississippi when it was dangerous, covered by Joan Baez. Joan Baez was in Selma. But all of us participate in this elegy for the Confederacy.
Let's take a call from Rachel in Brooklyn, who's identifying herself as a German Jewish woman. Rachel, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I need to correct you. I'm actually not German. I just happen to live half my life in Germany as a Jew.
Okay.
And I think your caller brings up such interesting and really cogent and important points that we need to take into account in America. And I would say my biggest experiential difference of living as a Jew in America and then seeing how Americans in turn deal with the legacy of their history of slavery, or I should say our history of slavery, is that, you know, for better or for worse, Germans have really been held sort of culturally and socially accountable by their neighbors in the West, by NATO, by Americans. And I don't only mean in terms of policy and the Allied occupation of Germany, but I mean just culturally, socially. I mean, Germans have an association with Nazism that I think for the most part they are ashamed of. And that shame actually works positively, I would say. Americans, on the other hand, are not really held socially accountable for the legacy of slavery and real racism by Europeans or by our neighbors in Canada or Mexico, for that matter.
Rachel, I'm going to leave. I'm going to leave it there and get a response. How much do you agree with her premise? And if you do agree with her premise, do you think a sense of shame for the past is something that needs to be and could be cultivated more in this country?
I absolutely agree with that, and perhaps more importantly than me, one of my heroes, Bryan Stevenson, who I interviewed for this book, also argues that what we need is the sense of shame. I interviewed him partly because he's the only American of national influence who said explicitly that his work for the lynching memorial was influenced by what he saw in Germany. So I do agree with that, but it's important
to
point.
And for people who don't know, that's the lynching memorial in
Montgomery,
Alabama. And Bryan Stevenson has done remarkable historical work on that.
And anybody who hasn't seen the lynching memorial should make a trip to Montgomery. It's what deserves the real word awesome, which is overly used. But I think it's really important to point out that although the caller is absolutely right that other nations identified Germany with the Nazis to the point that lots of Germans in my generation, when they traveled, tried to pass themselves off as Danish or Dutch or something. The outside attempts at denazification by the Allies did not really work. Germans made fun of them.
Hmm.
You know, I think this is a process that needs to come internally.
Hmm.
I do wish Americans would pay more attention to what the Declaration of Independence calls what is he called? Jeez, why am I forgetting this? The Considered Opinions of Mankind, or
I'm not sure exactly. You know which what reference, but you're talking about international opinion.
Correct. I actually think that the caller is maybe not aware of how much condemnation the United States has had for its racist policies from abroad.
So we're going to go from that. There isn't the same sense of shame or reconciliation with the past from a listener who lives in Germany to a listener from the South, but it's the South Bronx. Jim in the South Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jim.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. What's this? Germany was totally defeated after World War II, and I think that had a lot to do with eventually forcing a reconciliation with its history. But although the Confederacy was defeated, the system of racial supremacy there was not. That was left pretty much intact, and it really wasn't deconstructed the way anti-Semitism was attacked and deconstructed in Germany and in Europe. I think that has an important distinction, if your guests would like to address it. And can I just interject one other thing?
Mm-hmm.
Could it be that I've often thought that the real problem in the United States was not the history of slavery, because that's like the second oldest institution in the world, it's racism. And racism comes in after slavery. And I think it's actually the ideology of race more than the history of slavery that really has to be engaged with. And I'd like to know your author's opinions.
I'm just curious, Jim, if I can follow up. Why do you say racism comes in after slavery rather than during slavery and persists?
Without getting too technical, I'm an academic. I teach on this stuff. And, if you look at the early history of slavery in the United States, the founders all thought of it in terms of history. They didn't have a racial ideology. You go back and look at Thomas Jefferson and George Washington, what they wrote about the problem of slavery, it was not racialized at that time. It's only in the 1840s and after that the ideology of race really consolidates the justification for slavery.
Jim, thank you so much. Susan?
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Two good questions. Let me try and answer them very briefly. So there are lots of differences, of course, between the American case and the German case, and the first chapter of my book goes into all the differences. Once again, it is important that Germany was defeated, but the most popular novel in the 1950s in West Germany was called The Questionnaire, and it was simply making fun of the denazification questionnaire. People did not take they went along, obviously, with what the Allies said. They were an occupied country. But this process of working off the past did not really begin until people began to do it internally. And I think that's important to know. The second question about racism, there's a sense in which I absolutely agree with you. Our original sin was actually not slavery. It was a theft and murder of Native Americans. So there's no question that what we are now calling white supremacy is at the bottom of both of those crimes. The reason that I chose to focus on the racism that arose from slavery and neo-slavery, because slavery didn't really end in 1865, is that I think that is the question that is driving so much of our politics today. It is what drove the backlash against President Obama that led to the current disastrous administration. And that seemed to me to be the most important thing to focus on at this moment.
And I guess by way of an example, the way Donald Trump, President of the United States, I don't have to remind you, talks about black people in black neighborhoods and politically engaged black people. He called the NFL players who engage in the peaceful, quiet act of kneeling during the national anthem to protest unjustified police violence. For that, Trump has called them sons of bitches. Can you imagine a German chancellor saying anything like that about Jews working against anti-Semitism today in that country?
Completely unimaginable. Completely.
You take on the topic of reparations. And listeners, if you're just joining us, my guest is the moral philosopher Susan Neiman, who has written a book called Learning from the Germans, Race and the Memory of Evil. She grew up in the South and lives as an adult in Germany. There were reparations, cash reparations, paid to some Jewish survivors, but you call the process mean-spirited and arduous. How so?
Well, the actual amount of reparations was really quite small. What were important were the reparations paid to the State of Israel, which was a tremendously poor country in the 50s when reparations were first arranged. And that was instrumental in building up the State of Israel. But the individual survivors who had to go through an incredible process of documentation, they were supposed to have two witnesses. I mean, what if all the witnesses were dead, who accompanied them or saw them in concentration camps, and they were actually paid less than widows of SS officers in the end.
And you grapple with the morality and practicality.
It was an important first in history that reparations were voluntarily paid to survivors. It's important to emphasize when we think about the reparations debate in America that the vast majority of West Germans were against paying reparations. This is something that politicians did over the heads of the people.
And you grapple with the morality and practicality of reparations in this country, and I gather you've come only gradually toward the idea?
That's right. I knew if I was writing this book that I would have to deal with the question of reparations, and I left it for almost last. And you often write books in order to figure out what you think. You have a general idea, but you grapple with what other people have thought and work something out. I was initially quite drawn to the anti-reparations views of some African-American thinkers who I respect very much. Cornel West is one, Adolf Reed is one, who have both argued against reparations because they say social democracy would be much more important and benefit the entire country now. I live in a country where Bernie Sanders is far to the right of Angela Merkel. And Angela Merkel is a conservative politician, yes. Because in Germany, as in all of Europe, things like education, health care, parental leave, month-long paid vacations and a host of other things are considered to be rights and not benefits. So even if you have a conservative government in power, as we do now, it wouldn't occur to anyone to take away those rights. I am much in favor of America going in the same direction. But while I was working on this question, I had to do a thought experiment and consider, well, what if a Holocaust survivor staying in Germany, and some did after the war, what if a Holocaust survivor got no more than the general social rights that were afforded to every other German citizen, including those who'd been Nazis or gone along with it? I think we would regard that as deeply unfair. And I had to come out in favor of reparations. Mm-hmm. I'm not an economist. Mm-hmm. I simply support H.R. 40. And
which is the bill in Congress to study ways of doing it.
Exactly. So I am arguing for the justice of that claim. Mm-hmm. And I have to say that when I finished that chapter last beginning of September, I thought, boy, are you going out on a limb? There's you and Ta-Nehisi Coates, and this chapter is going to.
You'll have to debate Andrew Yang,
right? Well, but I could not have imagined that half a year later, the House would actually hold the first debate on reparations. And I have to say the silver lining in this administration is that I think it's forced white Americans to understand just how deep white supremacy goes in this country's history and how much we have to deal with it.
Let me take one more call for you. Boris in Newark. You're on WNYC. Hi, Boris.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. A couple of things. First of all, about the reparations. My mother, for example, is a Holocaust survivor, and she's getting some money from Germany, but I'm not entitled to it. So that's just Germany pays directly to people. But anyway, not, my initial comment was about German history. Mm-hmm. I was, as a matter of fact, visited East Germany, and the line there was that German people did not have nothing to do with the Holocaust. It was just a small group called Nazis who did this. And actually, they were pointing to West Germany as the Nazis of that time. But my big comment is about the history as it's being taught right now in Germany. They have a memorial in Berlin to the people who resisted the Nazis. The ones is, you know, this famous Operation Valkyrie. We had the movie with Tom Cruise being the officer von Stauffenberg. Mm-hmm. So that was an attempt to kill Hitler. But nobody talks about the real reasons why they did it. That was basically the Nazis were trying to kill Hitler because he was not a convenient figure at that time. They were trying to have a separate deal with Americans and British to stop the Soviet army from taking over Poland. And if they succeeded, then we would have not known about the Holocaust. We would not know about the camps.
And Boris, I'm going to leave it there for time. Very briefly, do you confirm that history?
No, I'm sorry, sir. I'm going to have to correct you on that history. Just about anybody who knows anything about the 44 conspirators, the people who were honored in that silly Hollywood movie, knows exactly what you're saying. These were reactionary Prussian officers, often anti-Semitic, and they were trying to cut a separate deal and avoid capitulation. So while you are certainly right that when West Germany began memorializing people, they did memorialize the 44 conspirators who were very reactionary officers. Today, anybody who talks about them knows that that's not the case. The second claim about East Germany, again, I must correct you. The East Germans did not say that the German people were not responsible. If you care to read my book in the chapter called Cold War Memories, I quote all kinds of discussions from East Germany which acknowledged the guilt of Germany long before West Germany did.
And now the movie is going to have that stain on its Rotten Tomatoes page. Silly, Susan Neiman. We have just two or three minutes left, and I want to ask you two final quick questions, and they could be huge questions, but on Yom Kippur, which was October 9th, there was a murder of two Jews at a synagogue, an anti-Semitic hate crime in Germany.
Actually, they weren't Jews.
Oh, they were, the killer thought?
The killer tried to murder a synagogue full of praying Jews. Fortunately, the door was locked, and he couldn't shoot his way in, and in frustration, he shot two passersby who were not Jewish, which doesn't make it any less tragic.
Right. But I realized upon hearing of that incident that I was more surprised to hear that Jews were killed for being Jews in Germany than I would have been if they had been killed for that in the United States today. Is that a valid reaction based on the actual odds or climates of tolerance and intolerance?
Look, unfortunately, anti-Semitism is rising all over the world, as is nationalism. You know, if you want to count numbers, more Jews have been shot down in synagogues in the United States in the last year than in Germany. But, you know, I'm not trying to justify anything. It is horrible. What needs to be paid attention to is the reaction of the government. The president and the chancellor came immediately to Halle, where it happened. There was a huge demonstration in Berlin. This process of working off the past, it's not a one-shot inoculation against racism and anti-Semitism. It is an ongoing process. It is still ongoing in Germany as it is in the United States.
And so in our last minute, last question to the title of your book, Learning from the Germans, is it possible, in your opinion, for the U.S. to learn from the post-Holocaust Germans, or are the historical differences like racism being invented during slavery to persist after slavery just too vast?
No, I don't think they are. And I have been immensely gratified by the reception of this book so far. I expected an awful lot of pushback or, you know, just plain turning down. And I have just finished a month-long book tour literally across the country. And I have been moved by how many people from different backgrounds feel that there are lessons to be learned. Once again, I think this is the result, the odd silver lining of our ghastly racist administration, that it has brought white people to the point of saying, wow, we really need to do something.
Moral philosopher Susan Neiman. Her book is called Learning from the Germans, Race and the Memory of Evil. Thank you so much.
Thank you.